Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Hannah Timmins, and you are listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you to Hannah Timmins for introducing this edition of the Tennis Podcast. Hannah is one of our three executive producers and top folks, and just underlining the fact by introducing the show expertly there with Catherine, Matt and myself, ready to chat post Roland Garros and to talk about grass court tennis, which suddenly seems very, very strange. And when I've turned on the TV, I have really not been ready for this. It's come upon me before I've really had a chance to think about it. But I'm delighted to share a Zoom call with you both and to be able to chat to everybody and to be able to welcome Hannah as our intro. If you'd like to introduce a show, you can do that by becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast at intro level. Just go to tennis.supportingcast.fm, or our link is in the show notes. You can get access to the review show that we did straight after Roland Garros, which had guests such as Mary Carillo on, and Pam Shriver, and Simon Briggs, and Christopher Clary. We also did our Q&A show, recorded on finals day, actually, on men's finals day, with Catherine and Matt out in the open. And it was a lovely Q&A show, so there you go. Two shows to catch up on. But here's another one for you. Catherine, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I've got clay to grass whiplash, as I think we all have, players included. But other than that, great.
Yeah. Matt, I don't know about you, but I find the rallies suddenly very strange to look at because they're so different.
Yeah. What rallies? Yeah, it's all so fast and different to the clay. And yeah, we've had months of watching clay court tennis, haven't we? And I think that surface has probably become my favourite over the years. And suddenly we're on grass and it's all very quick, a bit like the grass court season generally, really. You sort of have to savour it while it's here. And yet I'm not quite ready for it coming so soon off the clay. It's always a little bit tricky, this first week of the grass. But I'm excited about the week coming. There's some really big events, and we'll get to see more of the top players. But yeah, it's always a slightly jarring first week on the grass straight after Roland Garros.
I always find myself slightly scoffing at the notion of grass court specialists in the year 2023 because people don't serve and volley the way they used to and that sort of thing, which is what I grew up with. But
he's ditched Maxime Cressy quickly, hasn't he, Matt?
Well, he's done next to nothing, hasn't he? So, you know, he's not worthy of it. Not worthy of my support, Maxime. Sort yourself out and you'll get it back. Which comes first, my support or his good play? Well, his good play, actually, if he wants my support. But actually, when I did turn on the streams and start watching matches involving players that I really haven't seen play tennis for some months and realise they're doing well, like Adrian Mannarino.
I was going to say, are you talking about Adrian Mannarino?
And various British people.
I saw Adrian Mannarino with my own eyes today. Real-life Adrian Mannarino. I know, yeah. The glamour of my existence, David. It's a lot to take in.
They're all half volleying off the baseline. Nobody's taken a backward step. Nobody's hanging around with the line judges at the back of the court. These are things that are just very clearly different. Short take backs, parrying returns, and, you know, using the pace of the opponent's shots, all that sort of thing. And you realise, actually, it is a jarring difference. And in its own way, I do love it too. I've got used to clay now, so I'm going to have a bit of a mental shift. I think it helps now that we're about to go into Queens and Halle Week, and Birmingham in on the women's tour, and Berlin as well is going to be played. You know, that's the next level up of tournament, isn't it? There've been some good tournaments this week, and I think, to be honest with you, I think I've needed a week to just have a bit of a break, even from tennis. Just, you know, I mean, I've watched the last couple of days, but I've needed to tune out. I don't know about you. I mean, do you find that?
Yeah, absolutely. Perhaps not the thing to lead with at the start of a tennis podcast, but I've watched a lot of other sports this week. I've watched a lot of cricket for obvious reasons. I've been trying to stay up late enough to watch some golf, and I'm in a real quandary about what to do tonight, because Rory McIlroy doesn't tee off until 11 p.m. ish our time, which is just, it's an absolute catastrophe for UK golf viewers. And I wish they would factor that in when they're choosing the locations of these majors. Look, nobody loves tennis more than us. Trust me, we love it. There is too much of it. There is too much tennis. I don't want to be in a position where I'm feeling like, oh God, I need a few days off from tennis. But I did this week. I did. I've caught up. We know what's going on. Please don't tune out. We have things to say, I think, in this podcast. But yeah, it is absolutely relentless. And the players generally, unless you're Novak Djokovic, you don't really have the luxury of going, I'm going to tune out for a few days and just watch the Ashes. I mean, I had TMS on my phone in our little interview position at Queen's today while we were waiting for the players to be brought to us. So I had to switch it off every time a player sat down, and a couple of them asked what it was, and I explained about cricket, and the faces they pulled at the mere mention of cricket was, look, I won't name any names, but shame on them, the lot of them. They don't have that luxury, do they? I know that not having that luxury comes along with, you know, a lot of luxury and money and all of that. But, God, it is a lot, isn't it? Tennis is a lot.
I saw Tommy Paul on his Instagram was watching cricket, and he said, would you rather watch this or pickleball?
Oh, God.
Which was just insulting, wasn't it?
I hope his answer was cricket.
He was leaving it up to the people. I voted cricket on his poll.
Right. There's actually a poll. Oh, God. Right. Well,
sorry,
you found your solution to me not liking polls. but anyway, goodness me. Yes. Listen, let's... by the way, I think I have come up with a strategy for the golf, Catherine. I think I'm going to go to bed very, very early tonight, set my alarm early, record everything, and then just flick through the best bits and get to the last hour. That's my strategy.
I can't do that.
Okay.
You've both I'll got let you much know more faith in Rory McIlroy than I have.
It is okay. Absolutely not that at all, Matt. It's that if I go to bed and don't stay up for any of it, it'll definitely be the one where he doesn't blow it, won't it?
Right.
It's the ultimate first world problem, people. Tune in next week to find out what I did.
Yeah, well, the issue Catherine's got is a nice one, a nice quandary, because she is going to be presenting Amazon Prime Video's coverage of Queens tomorrow. So that means a very, very early rise. It also means, Catherine, that you've been at Queens all day today, as you suggested there, doing all the interviews with the players as they've come on through. So before we round up everything else that's gone on over the past week or so, who's been coming across your camera lens and sitting in front of you?
Well, the biggest omission, of course, is Andy Murray, who was unavailable in West London today for reasons that I'm sure we will come on to talk about very soon, and Francis Tiafoe as well, also not available for interview. But the top two seeds came across my path today, Carlos Alcaraz and Holger Rune, both making their Queen's debuts. Cameron Norrie, of course, a finalist at Queen's 2 years ago and a Wimbledon semi-finalist now, Dan Evans as well. Who else did we have? Lorenzo Musetti, Sebastian Korda, who plays Dan Evans in the opening round, Alex de Minaur, who's drawn Andy Murray in the opening round, Taylor Fritz. Who else did we have? Brian Penniston, remember him from Heroics of last year? He's back. Milos Raonic, actual Milos Raonic in the year 2023, was on the list of requestees, but he was unable to make it today, and he will be doing his media commitments tomorrow. So we missed out on Milos Raonic. But yeah, it was a smorgasbord of tennis players. Oh, Ben Shelton as well. I knew I was missing one. Ben Shelton. And he was probably my highlight of the day, actually, because it was my first chance to interview him one-on-one. I'd never done that before.
Why was he your highlight? Apart from the novelty element, what was he like?
Oh, he just made me feel like, can I be you, please, just for a day? Because it just looks so brilliant. He had all the other... He came at quite a busy time. There were four or five crews set up, and they were... You know, it was a juggling act, sort of musical tennis players, and all of the other players that were there at the time that Ben Shelton was were interacting with him. It felt like everybody just wanted to intersect with his orbit in some way, because it looked like the place to be. I think he backs his game on grass. He really backs his game to work on grass in quite a pragmatic, realistic way. I don't think he's expecting to win Wimbledon this year. He's very much got a, this is my first lap around the block, I'm taking it all in and seeing what's what attitude. He emphasised the fact this was his first time in the UK. It's one of his first times out of the country. He's been solidly on the road in Europe now for a couple of months, and I feel like it's sensory overload for him, and he's loving it, but it is a lot for him. But my absolute favourite thing about the interview was actually something that happened just afterwards, just as he was removing his mic and de-rigging. I clocked the T-shirt he was wearing. Said it was unclear exactly what it was, but it said Atlanta 1977. And I said, oh, what's the significance of the T-shirt? And he said, oh, you know, the Atlanta tennis tournament. This is a T-shirt from that tournament in 1977. And I said, was that your dad's then? And he said, yeah. How cool is that?
That's very cool.
Am I right in saying that his dad has now stopped coaching at the university and is going to travel with Ben full time on the tour now?
I believe so, yeah. He certainly said his dad had been quite significant in terms of helping him with, you know, a few tips and tricks for the grass and pointing him in the direction of YouTube videos to watch. To gain other tips and tricks. I think he said his dad had been to the fourth round of Wimbledon, which is pretty good going. So look, I'm not expecting him to win Queens or Wimbledon or necessarily, you know, reach second week of Wimbledon, but I think he's likely to be just outside the seeded spots. Might get lucky if he has a good week at Queen's, or if some players drop out. He's hovering on the cusp, but I guarantee the seeded players will want him seeded.
Yeah, he's probably not going to know enough yet, is he, to be as dangerous as he will be in the future? Yeah. But the raw materials are there, and I mean, remembering his dad as a player, I'm quite sure he will help him a lot with picking up that side of the sport. I actually saw a clip of his dad talking on the Wimbledon Twitter feed today, and it was a really nice little sort of interview of Brian Shelton talking whilst Ben was sitting next to him and talking about how he and his wife are more worried about Ben's development as a human being and to become a good person, and rather than what he ends up as a tennis player, kind of that'll take care of itself. But this whole journey, this whole sort of 6 months traveling Europe and seeing everything, just seems to be just part of life experience as much as anything else. And he's taken a few shooings out there on the court, hasn't he? He's been beaten pretty handily on the clay at times, but crikey, what a university in itself.
Yeah, I love his attitude to life. Time will tell whether that attitude to life translates into maximum success on a tennis court, but I'm one of those people who I want my orbit to intersect with Ben Shelton's. He's got a house for the month in Wimbledon. He's doing the full Wimbledon thing of staying there in a house, and we learned from his Instagram today that that house has just come with dogs, bonus dogs. He didn't know there were going to be dogs when he booked the house, but it's come with dogs and they look great. And yeah, I can imagine just being one of those people that, like, of course there's excellent dogs, because I don't know, good things seem to happen to Ben Shelton, and I wish him all of those good things. He's definitely got an aura about him, I would say. He's good vibes.
Yeah, he sure is. While we're talking Queens, I mean, I'm curious, first of all, to get your view, Catherine, on how Alcaraz and Rune seemed as people who haven't played a whole lot of grass court tennis. I mean, Alcaraz played Wimbledon last year. He pulled out of Queens. He came in injured. He, you know, ended up losing to Jannik Sinner. What do they seem like? I mean, it's a week since Roland Garros.
Yeah, interesting one. Alcaraz, he's a lot less comfortable with his English in a one-on-one interview situation, is my takeaway. His English is perfectly fine. I think it's probably better than he realizes, but he's definitely tentative with it, and very cautious and methodical about what he says. So I'm going to say that I'm reluctant to read between too many lines, but I'm also going to read between some lines and say I don't know if he is perhaps quite chastened by what happened in Paris. Actually, I think he'll bounce back relatively quickly. I don't expect it to throw him way off course, but I do just wonder if it might shake him for just a little bit. Just, you know, everything's been in his power so far in his career, and that must have, I mean, obviously we knew at the time it would have rocked his foundation. It's almost like his DNA betraying him, you know, that the pumpedness that is so at the root of everything that is Carlos Alcaraz, that ended up, we think, being his downfall in that match against Novak Djokovic. All of that nervous energy translating into crippling injury. And I do just wonder if that has actually rocked his foundations a little bit, and maybe that combined with it not being the most comfortable time of year for him on grass. I mean, I don't doubt at all that it is in his ambition and his power to conquer grass. And he may be just so good a tennis player that he can weather that storm, weather this mini crisis of confidence, and stay in tournaments while he's weathering it. And get to the latter stages, by which point you'd expect the confidence to have been restored. But I don't know. I think it could be an interesting couple of weeks for Carlos Alcaraz. And Holger Rune, it was a really interesting one, because he's very aware of his inexperience on grass. I think he's played a couple of matches. Just on that, by the way, Ben Shelton, I said, you've never played on grass before, though. You've never played on grass before, right? And he said, no, I've played on grass. I played yesterday in doubles qualifying. When he started that answer, I was like, oh my God, have I cocked up my research really badly? Is he sort of secretly been playing grass court challenges all his life or something? No. One doubles match yesterday. And yeah, so Holger Rune, obviously really, really conscious of his inexperience, but also completely unable to turn off his ambition tap. I said, what would a good grass court season look like for you? What would you be happy with this grass court season? And he said, he sort of said, well, you know, I've not played many matches and I don't know this surface well yet. And I'm trying to adapt my game and figuring it out. But also, I'm never happy unless I win the tournament because that's who I am. So
It was, I love it.
Yeah, I love it too. He's obviously trying to reconcile those two things in his mind. And I love that he laid that all bare. It was very revealing.
Mm, yeah. Ben Shelton and Seb Korda, by the way, lost that doubles qualifying match 6-1, 6-4 to somebody called Goranson and McLachlan, who I don't know an awful lot about, but they absolutely handed it to them in Ben Shelton's first ever match on grass. So we'll see how he gets on. I'm curious to know who all of these players are playing against, Matt. It's an interesting draw, isn't it? Because Alcaraz is the top seed and yet inexperienced on the surface, relatively speaking. You've got people who are very experienced on it, but maybe not very highly seeded. So what are the highlights as you see them?
Well, Carlos Alcaraz had a qualifier next to his name when the draw came out, and that got extremely exciting when the qualifiers were placed, because that is Artur Fis.
Okay, now we're talking.
So I suppose Alcaraz has found someone who's less experienced on grass than him there, I imagine. But yeah, sign me up to watch that one, please. That should be explosive, I think.
And I think that's tricky because Fis has come through two rounds
of qualifying.
Yeah, and I watched him.
Yeah, and he got a good win.
Yeah, I wasn't able to watch too much of his final qualifying match against Alexei Popperin, who I think does like the grass and probably should have had better results on grass than he actually has done so far in his career. But I watched him from a couple of meters away. It was on one of the outside courts at Queens. You're practically standing on the court when you're watching. And yeah, I was watching him try to figure it out, where to return serve, how, when to take his racket back. He's got the athleticism and the physicality already. He looks so physically comfortable on the surface. And I was incredibly impressed with how well he was moving on it. He looked balanced. I think it helps that, I mean, as we speak, actually, it is raining. But it basically hasn't rained in the UK for the last month. So they're not dewy grass courts. Sometimes when they're wet, inexperienced players look really all at sea, don't they, with their footing on the grass. So I think that helps. But yeah, movement wise he looked really comfortable. It was more kind of the timing on it, and I wasn't able to see the latter stages when he fought back to win that 7-6 in the third. But I think that's a really dangerous first round opponent for Alcaraz.
And Holger Rune has got the aforementioned Maxime Cressy.
Ooh.
That's quite fun. They've met a couple of times already this year, and it's one all in their head to head. And you know, I think Cressy, as we know, he backs himself, doesn't he? And he would certainly want to play Rune on grass, I think. It was, you know, last year he had a very good grass court season, Maxime Cressy, but he lost his first round this week. So that's an interesting one as well. Other matches that stand out: Andy Murray against Alex de Minaur. I'm sure we'll come on to talk about Andy Murray quite a lot in a moment, but that's a real step up for him, given the players that he's been playing and beating recently. Tiafoe against Van der Zandschulp, Dimitrov against Rusevori. Rusevori, who reached the semis last year at Queens, I think. And also Milos Raonic against Jordan Thompson. I think Jordan Thompson in his own right might be a little bit of a grass court specialist, I think, as well. I'm just find myself quite intrigued by Milos Raonic at the moment.
I saw him with my own eyes as well today. In the flesh, Milos Raonic on a grass court.
And I think they played already this week, Raonic and Thompson. And Thompson won, so Raonic out for revenge there in round one. Yeah,
Raonic did get a win, didn't he?
Yeah,
on the grass. I mean, which, you know, given how long he's been out, that's good going, really.
Yeah, he beat Kecmanovic in straight sets, and by all accounts, played really well.
Yeah, in all honesty, I've joked about it. And I will continue to joke about the Milos Raonic comeback, because he just wasn't on comeback watch at all, was he? That's the gag, that he was completely out of our tennis mind, well, our entire minds.
I thought he was going to retire.
Yeah, I kind of thought he had, but just hadn't announced it. So sort of to think about him again is very... Yeah, it's quite a bizarre thing. But I was a bit disappointed I didn't get to interview him today, because I suspect that might actually have been really interesting.
Yeah, agreed. Well, you mentioned Andy Murray, and you also mentioned Francis Tiafoe, two players who've played this week and have been successful. So let's talk about them. I mean, Andy Murray first, as somebody who, you know, you talk about Jordan Thompson. It was Thompson who beat Andy Murray when Murray was world number one and the all-conquering returning hero, wasn't he? Just before he started to get the worst of his hip problems. And, yeah, I mean, Murray's now playing challenger events, and he's played two back-to-back challenger events in Surbiton and in Nottingham. You know, and if you don't know what challenger events are, I mean, the vast majority of you will, but I mean, this is the rung below the tour, and yet I'm a big advocate of players improving their fortunes going forwards by playing challengers and by playing qualifying. Dimitrov, for whatever reason, didn't enter the tournament. I mean, in the past, I think he's just not signed up on the time at Queens, and he's been in the qualifying again this week. He wouldn't have needed to if he'd have entered the thing, but he's got two matches under his belt now. And here's Andy Murray. He's just won 10 matches in a row on grass heading into Queens. I mean, I think my view is that's just a really, really good idea. He's had this week... Ivan Lendl has actually been in Nottingham, which I think is a heck of a statement as well. To have your super coach courtside, not just the rest of your coaching team, who he usually would expect to have, but this is all in Andy Murray right now on this grass court season. It feels like pretty much now or never the way he's approaching this. I'm going to go all guns blazing, try and wring out every last drop of potential in myself. Who knows whether he'll be trying again in a year? If either way, we don't know. But I love the fact that he's gone all in. My one concern is just how much output he's already sort of put in and got out of this spell. Last year he had a good run and he ended up injured before Wimbledon. It does give me a little bit of a concern in that regard, but there's not really much point in thinking like that, is there? Overall, Catherine, 10 matches played, 10 matches won. That's bloody good going, even if you are playing lower-ranked opposition, right?
Oh, hell yes. I mean, I'll let Matt take the reins on this one, because I think he's managed to watch a bit more of the matches than I have. But you say now or never, and I agree with you, but just to signpost that in his Nottingham victory speech today during the ceremony, which was wonderful for so many different reasons, and yet the sight of Ivan Lendl sat in the crowd in this teeny tiny stand literally at the tennis center I played at while I was at university really really did make me chuckle to myself. But yeah, on the now or never thing, in his speech he said, "I'll see you next year, Nottingham." And
great.
Yeah, you just can't help himself, can he? It's so great.
Yeah, I agree, David. I think this has been really positive for Andy Murray. I would say I think he's got better as these tournaments have gone on. Like, I watched him at the start of Nottingham and he was playing okay. But by the end, in the final today, I thought he was really playing well. It's obviously tough to judge the level exactly. He's playing Artur Kazo, a guy ranked about 180 in the world, young player who'd never really played on grass before, and Murray's experience just told. But he looked to be moving really well, which is always what I look for with Andy Murray these days. I trust the hands. I trust that the game can be there, especially on grass. But movement-wise, I thought he looked excellent. And honestly, these are the kind of results where, you know, winning back-to-back challenger titles, we would really take note, for example, if someone popped up in the second week of a Grand Slam who we didn't really know too much about, and then we'd read that they'd won back-to-back challenger titles coming in, you'd think, wow, okay, they were really showing some form, and it's perhaps not a surprise that they've reached the second week of the Slam, you know, Juan Pablo Varillas looking at you kind of thing at Roland Garros just gone. Obviously, Murray has, you know, ambitions of probably being more than Juan Pablo Varillas, but, you know, that is sort of the stage of his career that he's at now, that he is having to drop down to challenges to win titles. And if you add in that element of experience that Murray's got, he suddenly becomes a really, really dangerous player, I think, if he's fit, which he does seem to be. But, you know, we should caveat this. He hasn't won a tour match since Indian Wells. And he's playing Alex de Minaur in the first round of Queens, who is top 20. And he hasn't faced anyone in this little stretch who's higher than 69. That was Jason Kubler, who he beat in Surbiton. So it's a big gap. But I think Murray's factored all that in. You know, I think he's realised that he needed these matches to get some wins, because he just hasn't had that many recently. And he's got them. And now he goes to Queens, which has been his most successful tournament ever, a place where he knows he plays great tennis. And I think he needs one win, maybe, but two would definitely, I think, get him seeded at Wimbledon, which feels like it's been sort of the aim all along as well. So things are looking really good for Andy Murray, and I'm very, very excited for him, actually, because, yeah, he's just so pumped about it all.
He used that word, didn't he? He said, I'm pumped.
Yeah.
And how often do you hear Andy Murray say stuff like that? It was, I mean, obviously he said it like he was about to slit his wrists, but he meant it, didn't he? He's, I'm pumped. But yeah, he really is pumped. And I do think, you know, speaking to Dan Evans today, who has been in a really tough run of form recently and trying to just pick up from what he was talking about after he lost at the French Open, the sort of unfathomability of the sport. Winning is a habit. I know that doesn't necessarily make sense, but he's like, I'm playing the same tennis. I'm playing really good tennis, but basically I'm out of the habit of winning matches and I need to just somehow turn the tide to get back in the habit. He said, it's not about my tennis. I guarantee you I'm doing exactly the same stuff. All his metrics, you know, he hasn't lost a step or anything like that. It's just a trough of form. And I do think Andy Murray making winning a habit, I do think there's something in that. And particularly for Andy Murray, who does increasingly so in this twilight of his career, he gets into patterns, doesn't he? He was in that pattern of winning an epic first round and losing in the second round. And he kind of needed to have a break to break free of that pattern. Then he was in the saving match points or coming back from the absolute brink of defeat pattern. And he's got himself into a pattern now of winning and winning efficiently. And yes, it's not a given that he can carry that through to a higher level, but I think he's put himself in the best possible position to do that.
And if we didn't think it could get any more exciting, Catherine, then we had an on-court interview moment to savour. What happened?
Well, it was such a genuine, unplanned moment of loveliness in Nottingham. There's something so pure and wholesome about it. And I'm sure most people listening either saw it live or have subsequently seen it on some sort of social media, because it's gone every bit as viral as it deserves. But of course, today is Father's Day in the UK. And I think well, certainly in the States, because Taylor Swift mentioned it last night on stage. But I think potentially in a lot of places internationally, today is Father's Day. Happy Father's Day, Dad, if you're listening. You definitely are. That was referenced to Andy Murray in a question by the MC during the Nottingham ceremony. It's Father's Day today. And Andy started saying, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting home tonight and being able to see my family. And then suddenly the camera cuts to his wife, Kim, in the audience, waving furiously and holding up assorted Murray children to try and grab his attention and say, we're here, we've surprised you, we've been here all along and somehow you haven't noticed. But we were all here, all four of his children were there watching him today, and he started sort of, he was, again, in a very Andy Murray way, he was clearly extremely touched by it and he didn't want to get choked up, but you could hear his voice going and he said, oh, that's really great. You sort of see him trying to count. He was like, I don't know how many of them are there. And it had to be pointed out to him that indeed all his children are there. It's like he's had so many of them, he's losing track. And yeah, he was really, really touched by it and it was extremely lovely. And yeah, it'll lighten your day if you do get the opportunity to watch it.
How marvellous. I had cupcakes made for me by my kids. Aww. And they Aww. Were delightful. And they had a really good undercover process for making them yesterday, all of which I knew was happening, but which they didn't think I did know.
Did you pretend to be surprised, David?
Oh, yeah. Aww. I was massively surprised, Catherine. And they don't listen to the
like
podcast.
Like Andy Murray. Maybe that was all. Yes. Maybe that was a big fake out.
No, I think he was more surprised. it's the little conversations very quietly that they don't think I can hear. Anyway, Matt, tell me about Francis Tiafoe's week in Stuttgart, because he's had quite a week.
He has, yeah. He has won the title, beating Jan-Lennard Struff today, coming from a set down and then winning two tiebreaks, which kind of was the story of his week. He won five of the six tiebreaks that he played, and just reminded me of how good he was in tiebreaks at the US Open last year. He, you know, it's funny because sometimes I think of him as not quite being able to really bring it in the big moments, you know, like when he lost to Alexander Zverev at the French Open. That fourth set was just there for the taking, wasn't it, for him? And yet he couldn't close it out. But he does also have this ability to play brilliantly in tiebreaks, and he did that this week. And honestly, it was a fantastic final against Struff. You know, a proper, you know, sort of going back to what we were saying at the start of the podcast, proper grass court tennis. I mean, Struff really does play it, and I think we said he was playing grass court tennis on clay when he reached the final in Madrid, and how excited we were to see him play that actually on grass this summer. And he was attacking the net and just giving Tiafoe no time, and he'd just come off a win over Hubert Hurkacz, and he was in front of his home fans, and you know, it was all sort of set up for Struff to win that match, and it would have been his first ATP title. I think he's probably the best player on tour at the moment who hasn't won an ATP title. And, you know, he's 33 years old now. And the guy at the ceremony said, you know, he did a classic, you will win one of these. And I was thinking, he's 33. Like, he's really been trying to win one of these for a long time and it hasn't happened. It is absolutely no given that he's going to win one of these. But he did at least caveat it with, if you continue to play like this.
No pressure.
That's like saying to Lucas Russell, if you continue to play like this, you'll win Wimbledon one day.
Yeah, and then he lost in the next round.
Turns out he never played like that again.
But, you know, so on the one hand, it was disappointment for Struff, which would have been this amazing career moment if he'd managed to win his first title. But it was an amazing career moment for Francis Tiafoe, because he's now He's now reached the top 10 for the first time, which is a very significant milestone, I think, in any player's career. And, you know, I just tweeted that the top 10 got a little bit more fun because Francis Tiafoe is in it. And that is just how I feel about him and tennis generally. And I think talking about players wanting to be in Ben Shelton's orbit, I think Francis Tiafoe is another one. And number of players I've already seen, you know, go out of their way to send congratulations to him publicly on getting into the top 10, I think is just a mark of how well liked he is. And yeah, this is obviously his career high ranking, and that feels fitting because it does feel like, you know, since the US Open last year, this has been the best phase of Tiafoe's career. He hadn't won enough titles, I think would definitely be true, but he's now won a couple this year. One on clay, one on grass, to go with one that he's already won on hard court. So he's part of a select group of players now that have got titles on all three surfaces. He's a sort of triple threat. And I think grass in particular, you know, I was watching this match thinking it's not out of the question that Struff Tiafoe could be a Wimbledon quarterfinal. You know, they're two quality players in form, and yeah, there was very little to choose between them, and the match point was absolutely fantastic. Tiafoe should have put away a short ball. He didn't. Struff guessed right and passed him down the line with a backhand, but at full stretch, Tiafoe managed to get these soft hands on a volley and win the title. And he just sort of fell to the ground. You could tell he was really emotional and just how much it meant to him. And yeah, I think I sort of joined everyone in just being pleased for Francis Tiafoe. And yeah, I think it's a big moment for him, big moment for American men's tennis, having two players in the top 10 for the first time, I think, in 11 years. And yeah, Tiafoe, I really hope he brings it at Wimbledon, because he's just infectious when he's in a draw playing like that. I'm just drawn to it.
I think this could be a really big week for him, because it's on Wednesday of this week that the next batch of Netflix Breakpoint episodes drops. And Matt and I have done a full review show of these five episodes that's available for friends, I think. So become a friend if you'd like to listen to it. So I won't give away too much of that content, only to say I think Tiafoe is the star of these five episodes. He's the breakout star. He's the one that jumps off the screen. And you learn a lot about his relationship with Wayne Ferreira. And by extension, you learn a lot about him, I think, from the episode that focuses on him, which is his run at the US Open last year. And yeah, those episodes drop globally on Wednesday. And I think there's going to be a lot of spotlight on him, and even more so given the week he's had. And I back him to cope with all of that spotlight. I think it could supercharge him. You know, I think this could be a really fun month for Francis Tiafoe, and therefore for men's tennis.
I'd like to send some of the good vibes created by Francis Tiafoe and Andy Murray and Ben Shelton the way of Matteo Berrettini, because he's having a tough time. And yeah, he's been horribly injured of late. He left the court in tears after losing in round one in Stuttgart to Lorenzo Sonego. He's now pulled out of Queens injured. And if you think he won the title last year at Queens and Stuttgart, and then he pulled out of Wimbledon with COVID, and it's just gone from bad to worse for him on court for most of the year that's followed. You know, it's just such a shame, and wish him well, really.
Look at Karolina Mukova, Matteo. Curses can be broken, potentially, yeah, temporarily, but
yeah. Well, fingers crossed that both of them can have good health in the future, because I enjoy watching them and enjoy having them on the circuit, quite honestly. Nick Kyrgios is another player who's been injured of late and has come back this last week. He didn't look that fit, in all honesty, in his loss to Wu Yibing. So he hasn't got much time to get himself right before Wimbledon. And not surprising, really, given the amount of time he's been out of the game. I mean, I don't think you can just come out and turn it on after an injury of that length. He may he may struggle, to be honest, to make any meaningful impact the next few weeks. We'll see. Stefanos Tsitsipas was beaten by Richard Gasquet, who won his 600th match on tour in Stuttgart. And just to finish the men's news, we had a title for Talon Griekspoor, who is Dutch, isn't he? He's won in his home country. I mean, that's a great story. And Sert Hogenbosch beating Jordan Thompson in the final match.
Yeah, so that's back-to-back Dutch winners there, because it was this week last year where Tim van Rijthoven entered our lives for not quite 1 week and 1 week only. He did all right at Wimbledon, didn't he? But I think he ended up losing to Djokovic. Yeah. But, you know, actually, to be fair, the Dutch have got a sneaky good crop of players there with those two and with Bortik van der Zandschulp and Wesley Koolhoff in doubles. I always think when I watch them in Davis Cup that they're actually pretty good, the Dutch. Yeah, great for them to have two home winners in a row. That's pretty cool.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription.
Now, because of all the Andy Murray chat that we've had on the challenger level, which in all honesty, we wouldn't normally focus on. We've ended up talking more about the men's game than the women's game this week, which is not something we would ordinarily do. We will equal that up in the next week or so. But actually, there have been some interesting stories on the women's side of things as well, particularly in Nottingham, where Britain has had an all-British WTA final for the first time in 46 years since Sue Barker against Virginia Wade in 1977 was the last time. And this time it was Katie Bolter beating Jodie Burridge 6-3, 6-3 in the final. And, I mean, both of them have had fantastic weeks, really, haven't they? If you look at the players that Burridge has beaten, she beat Martinsova, Magda Linette, who was a semi-finalist at the Australian Open, Fretch, she beat Elise Cornet. I mean, these are really good players that Jodie Burridge has beaten, and I watched most of the final. Frankly, she did not get a look in. Katie Bolter did in that match, and I think probably all week long, what those watching her have thought, well, why doesn't that happen more often? I mean, big part of that is being the fact she had a stress fracture in her back when she was starting to make headway. Then the pandemic struck off the back of that. So she has missed a lot of time. I still feel as though this is a player with the raw materials to be a very, very good player. And she's up to 77 in the world, which is a career high ranking. It's a career first title. She's from Leicester, just down the road from Nottingham. So this was a massive deal to her. She was hugging her granddad in the crowd. Oh, it was all very emotional. But I've got to say, Catherine, I feel as though this should be a jumping off point for Katie Bolter now, not a moment to remember as a pinnacle of a career.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And I absolutely don't want to be down on her. I love those scenes as much as anyone. I totally agree with you that she has the raw materials to be a far better tennis player than her ranking to date shows, even accounting for the injuries. And it has been tough, without question. But yeah, I don't, maybe this is harsh, but I don't judge these British players who have an edge on grass over pretty much everybody else out there, players of similar rankings, just because they get to play on grass when others don't. I'm not going to judge them generally by how they perform in Nottingham or really at the grass court during the grass court season, unless obviously one of them has an incredible run at Wimbledon, say. Of course I'll take that into account, but this is a week in, week out sport, and I want to see them do it. I want to see them be factors, be on our radar for the rest of the year. And quite honestly, None of these British women have been for a long time, and I want to see it, but they need to do it outside of Nottingham, and I really hope this can be the jumping off point for that.
Dan Evans obviously has been pretty outspoken in comments to the media, talking about how the rankings don't lie and that they need to be higher ranked than they are, and that they shouldn't be in on wild cards. Now, Bolter's just won this tournament. She got to British number one at the end of last week, and she actually put a post out at the time saying that she was mulling over whether to actually post anything about becoming British number one for the first time, because that wasn't the sum of her goals. And she's then gone and won a title. She's now 77 in the world. That gets you into Grand Slam tournaments of the future, which is quite a big deal in itself, Matt.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was a week that British tennis needed, because it had been quite rightly, I think, under fire a little bit. You know, there were no women in the main draw of Roland Garros for the first time in a while. And with Bolter becoming number one, obviously, you know, partly because of the fact that Emma Raducanu has been injured and unable to play. But it was the first time that the British women's number one had been ranked outside of the top 100 since 2008. It was, you know, things were bad like a week ago. And I think exactly as Catherine said, just because they've had a great week in Nottingham doesn't make up for all that. But it's timely, and they did need it. And it wasn't just Bolter. Obviously, three of the four semi-finalists were British. And Bolter beat Swan in the quarterfinals as well. You know, there were a lot of Brits doing well in Nottingham, but of course they do have that edge on grass. But given all that, it felt quite fitting to me that Bolter be the one to end up winning, because out of that crop of players, Bolter, Swan, Burridge, Dart, I've always thought Bolter is the one with the biggest game and the most potential. And if this was it sort of felt like a sort of national championships by the end, given that there were just so many Brits there. It felt fitting to me that Bolter won that, and she feels like she's got the highest ceiling to her game. And I think it's significant for her now that she's actually ranked higher now than she was before the stress fracture in 2019. So it really feels like her career, that was just absolutely interrupted by that injury and then by COVID, obviously, she's back at that point now with a few years on, a bit more experienced. Can she now build on that and become the player that we really thought she could be? Because we saw in the final, she's got the game. She can dominate behind the serve. She's got massive ground strokes. The way she was giving Burridge no time on the ball was really noticeable. But yeah, it's not just about doing it for 4 or 5 weeks over the grass court season. It's about embracing the grind of the tour. And I don't think any of those players have ever, for whatever reason, really done that. And I think now feels like it's the time.
And let's not forget, Bolter got a fantastic win last year at Wimbledon, one I commentated on, against Karolina Pliskova, a Wimbledon runner-up from the year before. So the ability is not in question. But now she's had injuries, but we've barely spoken about her really since then. And I think that's going to have to change. Not because of us, because of her. If she wants to achieve her goals, her name needs to be coming up on a show like this because she's relevant. And that's for her to now work on and build on. But can't do any more than winning a title and also having a nice little bit of aggro with Harriet Dart in the semis as well, which was enjoyable.
Yeah, that was serious. That was cold, wasn't it? Their little exchange at the net afterwards. I hadn't quite realised, but my new understanding is that there's never been any particular love lost between those two. But I wasn't aware that it was an aggro type situation. Obviously, I loved it. It seemed so petty. I couldn't, despite the many times I watched the video of it, I couldn't quite get to the bottom of what was being complained about. Dart was complaining about Bolter doing something, and Bolter was saying, "I do that every match. Get over it."
I think it was pointing about to pointing head. To her temple at the end of the match to say, you know, Stan Wawrinka style or Novak Djokovic style, "I'm strong mentally," I guess.
And I mean,
Dart taking exception to that, thinking it was personal to her, and Bolter saying, "I do that every match,"
which was one of the Tsitsidosa Easter eggs. The fact that Tsitsipas started pointing to his temple, Paolo Badosa style, he was giving us a clue there. But I'm pretty sure that Bolter and Dimonor are still together.
Yeah, they are. I can confirm that because Alex Dimonor was the first player to press today, long before anybody else came. He practiced early, then he did his press because he wanted to get out of the way in order to watch the Nottingham final, in which Katie Bolter featured.
Right. Mm. What do you mean by Easter eggs, Matt? I'm a bit out of the loop there.
Just a sort of little clue that something was happening. Taylor Swift drops Easter eggs all the time that her fans pick up on and read everything into about what the next announcement might be. And
quite often you don't realise it was an Easter egg until after the reveal. And you're like, what a fool I was. What a fool we were to think that Tsitsipas was honouring Stan Wawrinka with that celebration.
Exactly.
Of course,
it was Paolo Badosa.
It was a hint at his newfound soulmate.
I didn't even know Paolo Badosa did the finger to the head thing. Gee, I'm
well, we haven't seen her do much winning recently, have we?
No, I guess not. It's too long ago. Forgotten all about it. The other tournament that was going on this week was the women's event in Sertogenbosch as well, which I saw some of the final of that. Ekaterina Alexandrova beating Veronika Kudermetova in the final, 7-6 in the third, and it really was as tight as it sounds there. But it just felt like neither woman could really just take this match by the scruff. You know, they were both, it was like a tug of war and neither one's going anywhere. They're just sort of stationary. And in the end, it was Alexandrova who got the win. So well done to her. And it was a good first week of grass court tennis. I guess second week if you want to count Surbiton, but this is the one that felt like the real big one for the opener.
Big hitter, Alexandrova. Nobody's going to want to play her at Wimbledon.
No.
She's a danger.
There's a few of those, aren't there, with you, Sam Sonova and players like that. It's going to be a very interesting next few weeks to see who can get some form going, whether they can build on it.
I presume, David, you'll be predicting Katie Bolter to reach the final of Wimbledon, because that's what you did with last year's Nottingham champion.
Beatrice.
Well, in David's defence, didn't Hannah Meyer win like two tournaments before?
She
correct.
Did, yeah. All right.
That's right, Matt. Thank you for protecting me. actually, if Bolter wants to ludicrous. Back it up and do it all over again, I guess she's off to Birmingham now, where the two top seeds are Barbora Krejcikova and Yelena Ostapenko. And there's also... Is that Venus Williams playing?
You'd love to see it.
I watched her this week. I watched her this week on Tuesday, I think that was. She had 90 minutes of really good tennis and should have closed the match out in straight sets. Couldn't quite. And then sort of ran out of gas, I think, a little bit in the third set and lost to a 17-year-old, someone who was born during 2005 Wimbledon that Venus Williams was winning.
Amazing.
So that was Celine Neif, or Neif, I'm not quite sure how her surname is pronounced, of Switzerland. But yeah, Venus Williams is back, and she said she was pretty encouraged by how she played. And on to Birmingham.
That's so cool. She's playing Camilla Giorgi. We've got Alina Svitolina against Linda Frivertova. And then we've got an all-British clash between Jodie Burridge and Harriet Dart. In the Berlin tournament, there is Arina Sabalenka and Elena Rybakina as the top two seeds. Crikey, this is a strong draw. And I was mentioning Samsonova, Catherine. She's drawn Alexandrova in the first round. I mean, just imagine what the ball's going to look like after a few games of that.
It's stacked in Berlin. Yeah, that's going to be a really interesting week.
Yeah, I mean, a few other first rounds. Siniakova against Goff. Karolina Pliskova against Petra Kvitova. Sabina Lisicki against Caroline Garcia. Maria Sakkari against Elise Cornet. And I would love to watch Marketa Vondroušová against Bianca Andreescu. That is,
I think you can, David. Television
match.
Exists.
I will be watching it. Okay, well, that's about all the tennis that we've had this week and we've got to look forward to. We do have a mascot, and not only a mascot, but it looks like several mascots put forward by Carol Ray, who's been a provider of mascots for us in the past, including Stray, who we've met before and is known as Stray, but his full name is Astraea. And is a rescue English pointer. But Carol would also like to say, please also meet Albus and Zola. Albus is a Jack Russell Yorkie cross, and Zola is a golden retriever pup. We've got a picture with all three in them. And yes, the other two are Carol's son and wife's dogs, but they all play together so much she thought they'd put them all in. And Stray loves tennis balls and cheese, Albus is obsessed with any ball, and Zola loves food. We're a dog family, she says.
It's a classic can't get all three dogs looking at the camera at the same time dog photo, which is very, very relatable. But I'd say, Carol, two out of three is very good going.
Not bad, not bad. Talking to dogs, I have got Maisie. Catherine has got Xenia. Matt has got Darwin. And we're going to have predictions going off later this week when the newsletter gets put together. So make sure you're on the list for that. The link to sign up for the newsletter is in your show notes as well. Billie Jean the Dog is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Our top folks and executive producers are Hannah, who is doing our intro at the start of the show, Jamie and Drew, of course, and Matt, we have shout-outs.
We have Kate Bradley in Iowa.
Right, Kate.
Hello, Kate.
Kate, we never come up with a Kate,
do we?
Who
was that Kate that lost to Venus Williams on centre court at Wimbledon and randomly rocked up coaching Emma Raducanu last year? Do you know who I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Kate O'Brien? K- KT O'Brien. I was a KT.
That's yes. the problem we always have. You've perfectly illustrated
KT
it.
KT McNally, Kate Middleton goes to Wimbledon a lot, doesn't she? Will that do?
You sure that was Katie O'Brien who coached?
Yeah.
Emma Raducanu. You sure it wasn't Jane O'Donoghue?
Feeling a lot less sure.
It was Jane O'Donoghue.
Starting to feel a lot less sure since you've said that. Oh, God.
Okay.
Okay, well, Kate, I'm sure you'll agree, we've done you proud there with that shout out.
Thank you for being a friend of the Tennis Podcast, Kate. If anybody can come up with any good tennis, Kate, so that we can have a nice vault to sort of, you know, dip into if ever we need.
Thank you, Kate.
We're all ears. Thank you, Kate.
We've also got Stephen Malloy.
Hello, Stephen. We know Stephen.
All right, Stephen.
He is in County Clare in Ireland.
Oh,
lovely.
Stephen's top bloke.
The cameraman that I work with a lot and will be working with this week at Queen's is also from County Clare. What a celebrity name drop that is. Niall. There you go. Look, if anybody else knows anybody more famous from County Clare, please feel free.
How about Stevens? Have we got any Stevens? Sloane Stevens.
Stephen. Andy Roddick's brother, I think, is called Stephen. No.
No.
No. What a weird thing to make up. I'm not doing well.
His taxi, okay, Catherine?
His driver was called Stephen.
Oh,
Catherine,
well, there you go.
When he was in the UK. So, tenuous.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen.
Well, our final shout-out has actually provided us with a fact. So we don't even have to make up any names for this. We can just listen to Charles Friesen, who is in Vancouver. And Charles has come up with a famous Charles. Charles Williams, responsible for founding the ITF. He was killed in the Titanic sinking.
No.
But his son, Richard, who was also on board, survived and won the US Championships 2 years later.
Wow.
That's a tennis relived episode.
It is, isn't
That's
it?
It's an extraordinary story. Wow.
Thank you, Charles.
Great stuff.
That's fantastic.
Charles, thank you so much for the story and for being a friend of the Tennis Podcast. And
for saving these shout-outs.
Yeah. Andy Roddick's brother, by the way, is called
depths.
John.
Yes, I know.
So there we go.
All right, John, if you're listening. Anyway, thank you all
thank you,
for being shout-out friends of the Tennis Podcast. And thank you all generally if you are friends, because you help us keep the show on the road. And if you would like to help this show thrive in the future and you're not already a friend and you'd like to listen to many of our bonus episodes, I think we've done about 15 this year already, and as Catherine mentioned, we've got our review of the second installment of Netflix episodes, Breakpoint episodes, very soon for friends. We'll also have our review show of Wimbledon once that tournament's over. We've got our Tennis Relived to record in just over a week's time, when we're going to be featuring the life story and career story of Fred Perry. So, yeah, become a friend. Tell your friends about the show if you know anybody you think might like to have a listen. But thank you for listening. Do come back next week, and we'll speak to you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.